Close Encounters with Music is presenting Linda Hirschman and the Feminine Mystique at the Mount in Lenox this coming Sunday, Mother's Day, at 3 o'clock. It's part of their series Conversations With, intimate and stimulating conversations about music and ideas. Lawyer, best-selling author, and cultural historian Linda Hirschman has chronicled battles that have changed the social landscape of America in her books Get to Work, A Manifesto for Women of the World, and Hard Bargains, The Politics of Sex, as well as many others. Hirschman will analyze the 14th and 19th Amendments in tandem as two paths to equality in the suffrage effort as they affected private and public lives of women. Again, the event is Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Mount in Lenox, and we welcome Linda Hirschman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate having
you
here.
Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. So when you come to have this conversation, what is your ultimate goal and what you would like to accomplish in speaking on Sunday afternoon?
So I would, if I had a goal rather than just having an interesting conversation with other smart people, I suppose it would be to make women more aware of how central voting is to the accomplishment of social equality. The Close Encounters this year is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the passage of women's suffrage, the vote for women in New York State in 1917. And New York State actually, it's, of course, I don't need to tell New Yorkers how important New York State is, but it was indeed the tipping point when New York passed women's suffrage in 1917. It's the first state east of the Mississippi to enact full suffrage for women. And that's huge. The sparsely populated western states that had made women's suffrage part of their, you know, territorial development and stuff just weren't as important politically as New York was.
Right.
And if women sometimes, I just wrote another book that you didn't mention, which is called Sisters-in-Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and Changed the World. And many contemporary women and men, I'm sure, believe that women's equality was accomplished by litigation, especially Supreme Court litigation. And it is true, Ginsburg's series of cases in the Supreme Court played a huge role in the second wave of feminism and making women equal in the 20th century. But the bottom line, as both O'Connor and Ginsburg always recognized, is voting.
Right. When you make this case and the importance of voting, why do you think that that is as hard a case to make as it is in our history? Because certainly this last election was a very close election, but we've had those before. So what is it about our society and our culture that makes that a tougher sell than many of us believe it should be?
Well, 53% of the white women in America voted for Donald Trump in the last election. So
I don't understand that, do you?
It presents a problem. Why is it a problem? Because women are voting against their self-interest as women when they support an extremely conservative movement. There is circulating on the internet now a wonderful picture of all of the Republican senators who are charged with rewriting the health care law, and it is 30 white males.
Right.
So when women vote for that political party, they are voting against a certain kind of self-interest, an interest in equality, an interest in having their physical health compensated by the national insurance program. So we ask ourselves, why would anyone vote against their own self-interest? And I think there are two answers. One is they have other interests that are greater than their interest as women. That's one thing. For example, their interest as white people trumps their interest as women. And secondly, they don't understand how important voting is. And that's the piece of it that I would like to address myself to. Because you vote, you feel like one of a million, 100 million people who are voting. It's hard to understand how important it is. And yet, unless women use the gift of the franchise that they were given by New York activists in 1917, no court in the world can ultimately protect women if the voting public elects people who are hostile to their equality. So it's not dramatic, but it's very dramatic.
Let me ask a question, just because it's a diagnostic question, but you mentioned the photo that's going around, and it is startling to see it, of the 30 men who are in charge, white men in charge of rewriting the health care bill. Is that on purpose?
So did the Senate choose 30 white men on purpose, or did the Republican Senate circulate that photograph on purpose?
Well, my question is it done by design, or is it done just by a mindset and even could be done unconsciously of just we're going to go ahead, and because we have so few women in the Senate, especially Republican women, that it would be difficult? Meaning that is it sending a message to another base versus being done unconsciously and just naively and stupidly?
I think that it's a devilish combination of both. The contemporary Republican Party is very, very conservative, even against the history of the Republican Party in the last 100 years. Okay, let's leaving Lincoln out of it. So the women in the Senate, of which there are Republican women, of which there are, I don't know, two or something,
right,
are more moderate than the place where the Republican Party is. So if you just said we're going to govern from the extreme right of our own party, you would pick up an all-male panel, right? So so the question then is, why are any women Republicans? That's one question, right? Why isn't it cleaner than it is? But this is pretty clean. And part of the conservative program goes back to a kind of natural male-dominated hierarchy of power. They believe that male governance is natural and historic, and that it's not unjust that it be a group of 30 white men writing the rules for women's health. If women had understood the fight for their equality that we're celebrating at the Mount this weekend, then they would not vote for men who believe that they should be subjected or subordinate to them. So the really interesting question is, why are women supporting this program? But I think that picture is the natural product of the extreme conservative movement of the Republican Party. Since the Republicans supported women's suffrage in New York in 1917, it has gone very far to the right. And part of the substance of that conservative belief is that the natural subordination, or the religious subordination, has different sources, of women to men.
And so this would be easier to understand if perhaps Donald Trump was running against another white man. But he wasn't. He was running against a woman. And that is the head scratcher, isn't it?
Well, it is. There is a phenomenon of the tallest tulip gets cut down. So Hillary Rodham Clinton was the tallest tulip. And the feminist movement, and indeed all progressive social movements, have a history of taking down the most successful among them as an act of jealousy, unconscious jealousy. You know, when a woman succeeds, it sort of strips other women of the excuse that they're not succeeding because they're female. And that's a very hard lesson to internalize, especially since often women don't succeed because they're female. So there's the feminist movement has a long history of fragging the leaders. So that's one thing. You know, you could say a million things about Hillary Clinton, including the fact that she did not rise from the ranks as a political player, but rather married into power. I mean, that's an argument. And I would love to see our very own Kirsten Gillibrand, for example, being considered as a national candidate.
So let's say, and I apologize for interrupting, but let me just ask you, stop you there for a moment and say, so if that were to happen and she were to run, would she then become the tallest tulip?
Okay, so that's a great question. Good for you. Sometimes after a movement takes down its first leader, it stops, okay? Because then it gets to be like, well, there's the second one, and then there's a third one. And the presence of powerful, tall tulip women gets to be normal. So there was a tremendous amount of fragging of Gloria Steinem, for example.
Right.
And she handled that extremely well, I must say. But after that, you know, that behavior was not directed at the next person after that and the next person after that. So sometimes the first one is a sacrifice in that sense. And that should not be unfamiliar to Clinton because she was the first in a lot of ways and she has taken a lot of the hits for a lot of the rest of us. It is also true that a pure political candidate, someone like Gillibrand or, Amy Klobuchar, there are a lot of very promising Elizabeth Warren Democratic women, gets to be just normalized in a way that the first one who had to make a lot of compromises and stuff to get into power doesn't do. So I remain hopeful in that regard. But, you know, when you ask why would women do this to themselves and then wind up with, like, all their, you know, gender-related health care, reproductive health care and stuff in the hands of that picture, you have to know that there's a very powerful dynamic among marginalized people to mistrust the first ones who start to rise.
As you explore this, and we're just wrapping up, but as you discuss this, and especially the 14th and 19th Amendments, how much, when you talk about this, how much of it is a surprise to the audience in understanding that history?
I will say that I have been giving talks about my book, Sisters-in-Law, for a year and a half now. And the interactions with the audience changed 180 degrees in November of 2016.
Yeah.
Right, because O'Connor and Ginsburg are really the symbols of a very hopeful upward story, right? That's a happy story, how
yes.
They rose from, right. And so the election was a shock to me and to people in my audience. And we're just now starting to address ourselves to questions like the wonderful ones that you just asked. It makes for, I hope everybody will come to the Mount and to the wonderful concerts that Close Encounters with Music are doing this summer to celebrate the achievement in New York. I will say one last thing. Before the women in New York got the vote in 1917, they lost, okay? They had it on the ballot and lost in 1915. And so they marshaled what I will call, let's see, the resistance. And they campaigned like crazy in the intervening 2 years, and then they won. So it's at the end, it's a hopeful story.
Yes. Well, and I think it's hopeful just in what you said, that the audience and the questions changed as of the election, that there is an increased interest and people were shocked and alarmed.
They're looking for answers, and I have answers. Studying social movements is my life's work. So looking at what the New York women did in the couple years before they succeeded is really interesting, and I hope that we'll have a wonderful conversation and people will be inspired to get involved themselves.
Linda Hirschman and the Feminine Mystique will be discussed at the Mount in Lenox this coming Sunday. It's Close Encounters with Music presenting it. You can go to their website, which is CEWM, which stands for Close Encounters with Music, CEWM.org. Again, the event takes place Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts. Linda Hirschman, always a great pleasure. Thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing this morning. And thank you for your great
thank
work
you.
As well.
Thank you very much, and the same to you.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.